Welcome, welcome all. Welcome, nice to see you all. Block party night in Seattle. I haven't been to one, and I've lived here for 25 years. I've teach on Tuesdays. It's always on Tuesdays. Anyway, so welcome. Put together these series of talks, I'm not so interested in the minutiae of the practice. I think that there are many, many very fine teachers who do an excellent job covering that terrain. And because my energies are such and my time is such that I just don't want to spend it focusing too much on the how-tos. But much more looking at the expanse of where this journey goes. Now, for some of us, that's what we like to hear. For others, it feels like you're adrift on the Pacific Ocean somewhere. So I want you to govern, you know, your groundedness as we talk about things. And staying in the body, focusing on the breath, and keeping that sort of grounded earth quality can be very helpful when if talks get too far-reaching. Just listen with curiosity. If you listen with fear, you're listening in the wrong way. This is just throwing it out there for you. And it's not so bad tonight, but it will be in the future. Just to give you some warning. Tonight I want to talk about sort of the science and the art of meditation, the science and the art. And science studies the structure and the behavior of the physical world. That's what science is. And we want evidence that what we're doing has some basis of science to it, that there's a result that's replicable, and that's one of the qualities of any scientific research is that you can replicate it, that you can get the same results if you bring the same conditions together again and again. So in meditation, we want that. Let me give you a Buddhist story which shows the opposite of that. The Buddha was walking with a group of his monks, and there was a contemporary tradition known as the Hindu tradition known as the Jains. They're still there. Mahavira was the guru of the time, and he was a contemporary of Buddha. And so the monks came upon a Jain who was standing staring at the sun. And the Buddha said, "Jain, what are you doing?" And he says, "I'm wearing out my karma." And the Buddha listens and he says, "How much more have you got to wear off?" And the Jain said, "Well, I don't know." He says, "Well, how much have you worn off?" And the Jain said, "Well, I don't really know." And the Buddha said, "Well, how will you know when you're finished?" And the Jain said, "Well, I don't really know." And the Buddha, he wasn't belittling this man, but he wanted to make a point to the monks who were with him, and he says, "Monks, this is truly silly practice. This is truly silly practice. You see, we have to know the techniques and methods we're using move somewhere, that they're intended for a particular purpose. But even if they arrive at a particular destination, that doesn't, so what? What's the fundamental issue here that we're trying to figure out? For instance, if you follow your breath, I can guarantee you, if you do it with some degree of discipline and continuousness, or over time, that your attention will focus more, and you'll have better concentration over time. I can also guarantee that pretty much that everyone who sincerely works with metta, opening the heart, begins to perceive, or can learn to perceive, life from a different vantage point that allows more caring to come out of them. So that's the point of metta, is for that you open and access a caring and affection for life that you might be missing because of the way you perceive it now. So I can pretty much guarantee that those methods, and those are just two of many, many, many techniques that many of you do, or some of you do, that if you do them with sincerity, and not just perfunctory, but sincerely, that changes will result. But changes for what? Changes for what purpose? Where is it taking you? You see, the change is nice, and that's the science of it, is that to have a laser beam focus, you'll find it to be helpful to you. And if your destination is to make you a better listener, or to improve your attention span, or to just be able to focus, which is extremely important in almost everything you do, then that will be the destination for you. And if your destination in metta is for you to feel more affected by life, a deeper richness in your interrelationships, and less hostility and argument with life, then that will be the destination. But there's a much greater destination that the Buddha was pointing toward, and these methods, these procedures that we use, which are scientifically based in the sense that they do what they say they're going to do. They do change the behavior. It's observable. But if we don't have the greater sense of where this is taking us, then we get lost in the superficial, for lack of a better word, results that they do bring. And most of us, because we've had such a awkward journey of ourselves throughout our history, and perhaps one that hasn't been a lot of self-appreciation, then anything that takes the edge off of ourselves and gives us a better sense of our heart in relationship to life, or better able to tune in to life and its different aspects, is deeply felt and deeply appreciated, and that's fine, that's wonderful. But that's in some ways, it's a little bit like staring at the sun. It has its effect, it moves us in a certain direction, but not in accordance to the deepest fruit that the Buddha was pointing towards. And this is what my teaching is going to more and more emphasize, is that deepest fruit, because we get lost. You know, we get lost in the procedure, we get lost in the technique, and the technique then becomes the means, was the means towards an end, ill-defined as the end was, but now becomes an end in itself. Like, I just love sitting, I just love focusing, I just love the feeling of metta, which isn't to be discouraged, but it just isn't a complete story of where this thing is going. So I just want to keep us aware of where the story goes. What's the direction this takes? And that's what these continuum talks are meant to do. They start us in one place, but they take us in a far different reaches. And so this story of science moving towards art is really just that. I mean, we like to be certain. You know, we want to know that there are people who have gone before us that have proved the point of where we're intending our lives to go, and we see them doing this, and they teach sitting comfortably, square, cross-legged, et cetera, et cetera. And you think, okay, so this is the procedure that got them where they are, and I want to follow that procedure too. But unless we have a broader sense of what that direction is, we get lost in the procedure, and I've seen it probably more often than I've seen the opposite. So this is not a small concern. You know, these are what they call corruptions of insight, these places where we get fixated and lost. It's like a little eddy that just keeps twirling around and around. It doesn't loosen its grip because it has quieted a deep and dark pain that we live with in us. And we would rather satisfy that pain than to move to be pain-free. So this is the direction that the practice is going in. So when I talk about the fruit of the practice, I talk about it in terms that's very far-reaching. And for you, for some, it feels unapproachable or certainly out of reach where we might be at the moment. But nevertheless, it's the direction it's pointing, and that is non-separation. That's where the Buddha's message lies. That's where it's satisfied, where all these practices satisfy themselves. So when you have a practice like focusing your attention or opening your heart, it has to have some relationship to non-separation. It can't be an end in itself. It has to be an opening to something much more vast. And that's where I just want to keep us moving or thinking or questioning. And that is the other component, is that how do we, what's the way forward when you see the way forward for non-separation is to question your perceptions, because the perception I'm having, or some of us are having in this moment, is a perception of separation. I'm here and you're there. There are things of the world and I'm back here as a thing. Unless we question that perception, we're not really getting at the heart of what all of these trainings are meant to do. These trainings are meant to undermine the false way that we perceive. They're to show us the correct form that perception can take when we aren't hooked into life in a skewed manner. And so that's what all of this is about. Now, Dharma practice can become very mechanical for most of us. It becomes very routine. You know, we have our daily sitting, we have it timed, we're very disciplined, we get up and we do all the things that are necessary, but we don't invite the questioning in to that sitting. We do it almost like it'll take care of us. You know, if we just do it, that's enough. And that we feel the effects, and again, the effects aren't wrong or bad, they're very enjoyable, very beneficial. We've just lost the expanse of where this practice really is directing us. And so we want to, if you're interested in the direction the Buddha is pointing, which is a big if, then that has to fit into the equation of your procedures and your methods. And so the models of, you know, but the mind likes just the opposite. It likes the closure. It likes the evidence. It likes the, you know, if I do this, this is what I get. It likes the cause and effect model. It likes the science. It likes, you know, to know what it's doing and the effect it's going to have and how it's going to lead me forward. And then what happens is that what I need to do is to find the right method. So the weight is on the method, not on the perception, not on the seeing, not on the questioning, not on the understanding of what it is that's happening. All the weight goes to the method, to the technique. It's supposed to be my salvation. Other people have done it. You see? It's putting the weight on the wrong, whatever, foot. And so there's a book out that is on the progression of insight. And again, it's depicted as a, if you do this training, these are the sequential models of what your perception, what you'll see. And it's a, you know, you just get on the train car and the train will take you wherever it's going. And your job is to have a very focused internal experience of what's going on, but the emphasis on is on that sharp attention. And then as the microscopic view of what you're seeing turns up its magnification, so we all start at one power, and this turns you to a 500 power. And you see the world very differently, like you would through a microscope at 500 power magnification. And that's a way that we've never seen it before. And it's remarkable what you see at that level of nuance. And you go, my God, this is the revelation. Well, is it a revelation to see through a 500 telescope or microscope or telescope? Is that a revelation to see a cell differently than you look at your hand? Is it a revelation to see a cell splitting? Is it, in some ways, it shows you the world in a very different manner, but it doesn't change your life, does it? I mean, it didn't change mine. With or without that, I'm pretty much the same person, you see? And yet, we think because the microscopic tuning is in us, we think then that this is really something that is shifting us in the direction of freedom. Well, it's showing us things we haven't seen before, and so we have insights into areas that we have not seen, but those insights carry a blemish. I'm the one that's having it. It's me seeing myself. It's me seeing emptiness. Me, I'm seeing emptiness. I'm seeing a new Nietzsche, which is change. I'm seeing all of the different things I see, because when you have that kind of magnification and an internal response, you carry yourself with you. You have to, within a perception that's only one-sided, internal. It's not internal as opposed to external. Anytime you choose or select one over the other, you're going to have a dualistic display through that choice. In any case, so yes, you have these marvelous, and I went through this. I'm not talking about it abstractly. I'm talking about it from an actual experience of many months sitting in Burma doing what they told me to do. That's why I can share it with you with some degree of clarity, because I went through it. So you sit and you see yourself, but it leaves you mechanical. It left me mechanical, and for the most part, everyone I've ever spoken to that went through these techniques were left with the same mechanization. You think that what you saw and how you saw was because of the techniques you were using to see. Just like a microscope. You know, you get me away from the microscope, I don't know a cell, how the cells are acting. And so I've got to stay tuned, I've got to stay in this kind of pressure cooker samadhi encasement, which is very difficult to achieve, but once it's achieved, it's wondrous to see. And as long as I can maintain those circumstances, then I can see at that level of intensity and magnification, that's all I need. But we're tied to a method. You take the method away, I don't have the seeing anymore. This Buddhism is not about methodology. It's not about a particular way we're seeing. Realization is living the insight. Having an insight is just seeing something that you haven't seen before at a different perspective. You have an insight when you see a cell. Go, oh, wow, that's what my cells look like. But it doesn't, that's not a realization. It doesn't change us, you see. Realizations change us fundamentally. And to do that, you can't be dependent upon a method or a level of concentration. You have to live. You have to live it. If you live it, then all of a sudden you start knowing or living or abiding in the emptiness that you once saw when you were very, very fine-tuned and concentrated. But when you live it, you live it. It's like living it. You know, you don't have to bring it up as a memory. It's an ongoing expression. And that's where the Buddha is taking us. It's taking us into realization, not having an insight. And I think this is one of the crippling ways that this tradition in particular holds itself up, because when you're having an insight, you have a methodology that got you to see that insight, usually a set of circumstances. You know, maybe you were on retreat for 10 days. Now you got to go back on retreat for 10 more days to regain those insights or renew those insights, you see, which many of us get caught in, and which is fine. It just isn't the fulfilling story of realization. And it leaves us mechanical. When you're left mechanical, it's like when it doesn't start working for you, there's a point when methods fall apart, then you got to find another method, because you don't know how to access anything outside of a procedure or a technique. You've always used a technique for fulfillment. The other thing it does is it makes you dry inside, because you're not really being affected. You're so focused on something, and there's a distance that you're creating from you and what you see through that incredible concentrated mind, that it feels dry. It doesn't feel like you're being affected by life. You're observing it in some kind of impartial way, but the whole sense of the heart being connected to what you're seeing wasn't there for me, and no one else who I've spoken to has used those methods as well. Now, that's fine if you're sociopathic, because you don't care. You think you... There are a number of people who just would like to live without their hearts. But that's not the Buddha's way. Buddha brings you in totally, in summation, brings you in summation. You don't leave any part of yourself out. You know that? Those of us in the room who have such difficulty with our emotions, you know, would love to just carve that one out. I'll stay with the objective view, the one that doesn't require me to feel. Well, then you'll be very cold-hearted. You'll be very distant, and your practice will be dry. Having had hundreds of interviews with people whose problem is that their practice is dry and distant and cold, I know this is a problem for many people, because they don't want to be affected by what they see. They pull down to such a distance that they can see it, but coldly. It's distant. Well, this isn't the practice. This is a methodology that will take you to that, and that's that kind of cold, technological, isolated focus. Then where are you? You should always ask, is this all of me in here, or only part? Am I siding with all? Because nothing would get us, you know, every one of us has sections which we just like to pair off, do a little left turn here and move around it, shunt ourselves away from that. We bring it all, this is all, this is all of you, every bit of you, us. It all has to come. And how are you going to do that except through life? You see? And a method always has that, it's always partial. There's always something that's a limitation that you're imposing. You know, there's something that you're trying to get over when you're using a method. It doesn't mean that method use is wrong. We all use methods. But you should be aware that I'm using this method because I don't think I am what? Fill in the blank. That I'm caring enough, that I'm attentive enough, that I am responsive enough, that I am loving enough. I don't know. But what about the part of you that is framed against what it is that you seek? The part of you that feels cold-hearted? Are you going to leave that out? Are you going to bring that along? That doesn't mean it defines you to bring it along. It means that you just can't resist it in order to find its opposite. You find yourself and your true nature through all parts of yourself, not in spite of or in distance to. And so everything has to be included here. And the other thing that methodologies, especially these like progressions, you know, that people get caught up in, as I did, leaves you in control of your practice. Why? Because, again, concentration is a very dualistic technique. I'm concentrating. I see. It's not open. It's very narrowly focused upon one thing, like wearing blinders. So you, I, the observer, is in control. And for years into my practice, I realized I was in control of everything I did spiritually. I didn't know what it meant not to be in control until a teacher of mine said, I want you to drop all your methods. I didn't even know what he was talking about. I could not conceive of a spiritual journey without all the techniques I'd been using. So I didn't know what, I floundered. It took me months of floundering to figure out what he was even suggesting. Again, this is not to dissuade or, you know, against methods. It's just to know that every method has a limitation. And not to get so enamored by what the method is doing in one way that we don't see the limitation of the opposite. You're not marrying yourself to a technique. We're marrying ourselves to a journey of openness, of taking ourselves out of the cage we're in and walking ourselves into a whole different way of being. So the problem that I feel with much of this is that we're so technologically sophisticated, we think that, you know, technology can handle any problem. I heard a climate scientist saying he was with a bunch of, you know, Silicon Valley thing. So we don't have to worry about climate change because technology will take care of it. He says, no, it won't. We're going to have to take care of it. Each and every one of us. That there are problems that are, you just can't shunt off and wait for the right invention. That this is a human problem. And Dharma is really that way. A technology can't get us over our suffering. We think that if we just get over the problem, we'll get over our suffering. But getting over the problem is increasing our suffering. You understand what I mean? When we're in resistance and tension to something that's in front of us, which is what we, how we define a problem, we think the solution to the problem is doing whatever is necessary to rid ourselves of that tension momentarily. But in so doing, we set a pattern up in our life in which every challenge has a resolution, and I just need to find the right one. Meanwhile, I'm suffering all along the way. With the tension, I hold the challenge from which I hold the challenge. And all of the ways that I keep resisting and avoiding life as it shows up in its presentation. this is not problem resolution as we have known it to be. And if those of you who are in relationship perhaps have known the difference, speaking personally, of a male in a female way of relating to problems, at least it has been for me, in which my wife wants to talk about the problem to connect as a form of connection. I want to talk about the problem as for a solution, to try or to solve whatever it is that she's bringing up. Well, that's taken me years, decades, and I'm about this far. It just isn't, it isn't the way I look at life. It isn't the way I was taught, you know. It's like problem solving, arithmetic, calculus, algebra. Here's a set of problems, 6, 9, 14, but that's it. How did I do? You got an A. Oh, okay. That's what you're programmed. We're programmed that way. You see, and when you have a methodology, you have a problem. You bring on whatever you're doing as a method, it's because you have a problem. There's something that isn't being offered in the way that you would like. Life isn't presenting itself, or why would you use a technique or a method? It's because you want to alter something in your life so that, you see, so it's a problem, it's for problem resolution. Well, at some point, I love the poem I read, the one line that said, and flowed into the spirit's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all-surrounding grace. No effort earns that. And now we're out in the Pacific, people, so you know, raft up here. But I like the Pacific. It's really the only place I can breathe, really breathe. It's remarkable. The possibilities are there when we move this thing in the direction it's intended. Now my hope is, as I'm sure you've now heard me say, is not to take you away from your methods. None of you are doing anything wrong. Just get a sense of what motivates you to want that method. What is it that you think the method is going to give you that you don't already have? Ask that question. I'm not suggesting you drop the method. Just know why you're using it. And what's its value? How is it helping you towards the goal that you've set? And is there a limitation to its use? Are you feeling dry, cold-hearted, distant somehow? Mechanical, mechanical. Right? How do we bring the juice back into this thing, the heart back in? That's the art. See, this is from science to art. I wasn't going to leave you in the science. This is the art now. But this is when territory gets large. This is when the boundaries expand, you see, because the art doesn't it's not packaged. It's not packaged, and it calls forth a different dimension of us that the equation-driven sense of us, the problem-resolving need within us, can't find, can't discover, because it is antithetical, antithetical to this other dimension. If you use the laws of separation, you can't find your way out of separation using those laws. This dimension of unity, of interconnection, doesn't use the law of mechanics. It just doesn't. If you stay within the rules of mechanics, you will stay within the division of separation. That's an automatic. Because the way you're perceiving life through the technique is establishing that separation. I like to pause, you see, I have to let that sink in a little bit here. What do I do, sit around and, you know, just hope for it? You know, this is no. No, it's not wishful thinking, that's not the alternative. It's really calling it forth. Where's the quiet, the stillness in this moment? So, you know, I have gone through various periods of time in my journey that were very difficult, very difficult. And it wasn't until, you know, the last 2 decades that I learned how to call forth. Instead of trying to resolve. When you call forth, you call it forth. Where's the joy in this moment? You're not doing that out of desperation, out of disappointment, because there hasn't been any joy, and you want to know where the joy is, and it's the universe isn't in it. You know, it's not, you're not doing it in hostility or argument. You're doing it from wonder. Where's the joy? I know it's around. I know it. We've all tasted it. We all know it. Now, where is it? Now, see, we have to be willing to be quiet enough to see if it is around. We have to change the disposition. Now you're no longer within the throes of a method. It's not you pitted against something. You're wide open here. Is there joy here? Show up. I can't make you show up, but I can be quiet enough to see if you're already here. And that is not an effort to be quiet. I'm just so interested in whether the joy is that I'm willing to be quiet to see. How could it not be? You see, we're swimming in this stuff. No one has ever denied us access. We just use the wrong rules and laws. We use the old rule, our old rules. The rules we grew up with, the psychic rules of separation and distance and time and overcoming the problems and surmounting the difficulties. You see, those rules don't apply here. There's no difficulty here. You can feel it. See, art's braille. Art is braille. What I realized then is the mechanics were disempowering. It kept me contained. The method kept me in control. It controlled me. I gave all my power over to the method. And therefore it disempowered me. And this dimension fully empowers you, us. fully empowers us. Is it? Just look at the logic of it for a moment. I'm going to use my methods to get into the present. Is there, if you ever said that to yourself, I'm going to use my methods to get me into the present, you'd probably wake up from the sheer insanity of that statement. As if you could be anywhere but the present. Now, if you're always in the present, what are you going to use your methods to do? Take you out of the present. The circuitous route. See, I need to enter the present. I need to enter the present. The I is a thought believed. Now, if that's true, which is true, that's scientifically if I am a thought believed and the thought believed seems to keep me out of the present, what's the solution? You see, we don't go to the basics, the obvious. This is so obvious. How about being still? How about including your thought and you as part of the presentation of the moment, rather than as the overseer of the moment? As if you were somewhere else but the present, waiting to get in. You're the project, not the present moment. Let's bring these things together in ways that make sense. By just looking, I mean, just, those are just so obvious. But we don't give empower ourselves sufficiently to invite the obvious in. Because somebody who's been sitting for 50 years is teaching something else, and we think, who are we to question him or her? But it's only through questioning him or her that you'll ever find the limitations of yourself. And instead of seeing the frustration that a method brings, which all methods at some point bring a frustration, and incorporating that frustration in as part of the seeing, we think the frustration drives us to a different method. No, the frustration is saying it's a statement in and of a complete statement of itself. It's not saying something about anything. It's itself complete. Everything is complete moment after moment. No part of it is imperfect. It's all a perfect representation of itself. Every part of us, every part of us. Why do we let it drive us insane? My hope for all of us here is sanity. Can we sit for a minute or two? You don't have to journey far. You don't have to see at the cellular level. Here it is, right in front of us. So much of it is that we don't feel deserving of it because we haven't worked hard enough. And we have to satisfy all of our internal resistances, including that one, before we'll settle in and actually open to what has been here since for time immemorial. See, I'm not good enough. I haven't tried hard enough. I'm not sincere enough. And here it is. So if there are any questions or statements or comments, I'd be happy to respond if I can.
First, thank you so much for that clarity. The message is really, really helpful. And the question is that I'm still just having a little bit of problem reconciling that the sort of dualistic emptiness, everything is an illusion, almost scientific viewpoint with why does it happen that the heart and the love come out of that, and the teachings around being kind and how to. You know, sometimes I don't feel like I understand the teachings to be kind in a deep way.
So, to meld the sense of emptiness with the sense of the heart, and how those two work in cooperation. Okay. So, most of us know a life in isolation when there's me. We have a political opportunity to see the me in its greatest glory. Without naming names, that is what it looks like unabated, when there's nothing being tucked in, you know, when it's just. And so each of us have some characterization of that in us. Let's not deny the fact that we also carry that quality of self aggrandizement, or shame, so any expression of self in either the negative or a positive sense is the same thing. And how that, the way that we hold life in terms of that posture of I who is thinking or seeing, can't help but be a funneled focus to what I need in relationship to the moment I'm observing. I need this. And that's the way we go through life, is that funneled representation of our immediate mind's presentation as opposed to what reality is offering us. I like you, I don't like you, I need this, I don't need that, you bother me, you are. And that's the jabber, that's the filtering of our chatter that keeps us perceiving in that way. Now, where's the heart in that? The heart can't see through that. That's opaque. Because everything, the heart is still all around us. It's just being blocked by that sense of I focus. The sense of I focus is like a mirror that everything that hits it bounces away. So as we get, and you can do this in one of two ways. One is that you can begin to see what the sense of I, actually is, experientially. Now listen carefully. All expressions of form, which I is an expression of form, it's material in the sense that it can be seen, it can be felt, it can be sensed. All expressions can be known. Awareness has the capacity to see every expression of form, including the expression of I, if you want it. If you don't want it, it's not going to look in that direction. Okay, so one of the ways to bring translucence to this field of I is to see what the I actually is. And to start living that in a realized manner rather than just having an insight or two once every 10 years and thinking that's sufficient. Start living selflessly. Not as a should, but as an actual ongoing adventure into your life, into our lives. Okay, that's one direction this can take. The other one is to start with the heart, which is really the start with awareness, but we're not going to call it that yet. We're just going to... So we start with the heart, and we start working on the ways I shield myself from being affected by life, right? That's what the heart is to let life in. Now listen, get that point. That's an important point. It's not something outside, it's not over there, two buildings away. It's everything. But starting to look at it as a total, to be affected by everything, instead of shielding or defending or pretending or denying, just open up. Okay. You can't open up to, when you open up to all life, you're no longer seeing through the visual tunnel of eye. You can't do it that way. You're not going, the eye selectively chooses and sees what it wants to see. So if you start working the heart organ, you start opening up beyond that vortex of eye. That's another way of doing this thing. And when you start feeling or allowing life in and being affected by it, you'll feel the pain of it, which is the I formed around the defense doesn't like that pain, and it forms in defense so that it doesn't have to feel that pain. But as we mature, we open the heart anyway, and we just let it through the I. We let it through, and the I no longer surrenders to its defenses to keep it out. Is this making sense to you? No, it's not making sense to you. There's not a single person in the room that shook their... Sometimes I'm just talking to myself. It's frustrating to me because I know what I'm trying to say. Just wait a second. Wait a minute. Anyway, let me be... Okay, so as we exercise the heart, we also step out of the eye focus. And what you begin to notice is that you have this natural abiding love with things. That you don't have to force caring. Caring happens when you're not defending yourself against what it is that you see. And so then you begin to feel life as love. Okay. Life felt as love is the same as life felt selflessly. The same thing. Just looked at it from a slightly different perspective. That's all. Some people emphasize one, some people emphasize the other. But they both mesh perfectly as one in the same perception. Okay, so now whether you got that or not, at least get it intellectually, so that you heard the story. I'm not taking you anywhere but the truth. I have no interest in distorting the truth at all. So I can just tell you. And you can choose if you're drawn, like many Christians, towards the heart of Christ, then use that way where Christ is standing out in front of everybody like this. What is he saying? Not you. No, he's saying everything, everybody, all of life, everything. He's going this way. He's not going this way. And when you do that, you see why that stance is so universal, why it's so important. The problem is we're out on the Pacific. This keeps us in Seattle, 1901, 20s. this doesn't. Okay, thank you all. Next week we'll have a discussion on this, and if you're a little fuzzy around the edges of what we talked about, the discussion can shore up that understanding and bring it into a crystal focus. When we move too quickly through subjects, it's like, oh, I remember him talking. He said something about love once, you know. It's like, but what is it this week? It's about, you know, it's like, if you find your niche, stay with it. Stay with it. Read about it, explore it, study it. Make it your own, you know, don't move on. When you resonate like that, there's something inside of you that is feeding itself into glory. Okay.